Newell's got the day off. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm Dave Cohen. Glad to be spending the next 3 hours with you here on WWL. And we started a conversation when I'm normally on at 5 o'clock this morning that I wanted to continue here as I join you at 10 o'clock, well, 10:08, on the Newell Norman Show. And to help us with that, we've invited the chairman of the Department of History and Philosophy at the University of New Orleans, John Fitzmaurice III, to join us. Professor Fitzmaurice, thank you for being here on WWL.
Thank you, sir. And if I may take a moment to correct you, I'm not the chairman of the department. I am simply a humble professor here and happy to be here at the University of New Orleans.
Well, we'll take it. You are chair of the Veterans Day Parade for New Orleans, though, right?
That, sir, I am.
I knew you chaired something.
That.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for getting that corrected, and thank you for joining us. Hope you had a great Labor Day weekend.
I did, and I hope you did, too.
Yeah, you know, today is the day 80 years ago that the Japanese officially surrendered. And so today, September the 2nd, is the official end of the Second World War. And I guess we're very blessed that we have the National World War II Museum here in New Orleans with the mission of hoping that no one forgets what happened, because it really was, and you can't understate it, how much it changed the world then. And the lessons learned from the Second World War should never be forgotten.
Well, if you're looking for me to disagree with any of that statement, I'm just going to give you dead air for a few moments. But no, you're absolutely correct in that regard. The Second World War changed everything. And you're also right about how important the National World War II Museum, which, by the way, product of the University of New Orleans, the late Stephen Ambrose and Professor Emeritus Nick Mueller, who deserve tremendous credit for coming up with that concept. But you're absolutely right. The Second World War changed everything for the United States. It made the United States officially a global power. We kind of realized that a little bit after the First World War, but then we withdrew from trying to be involved in world affairs. And then the Japanese made the decision for us to involve us in world affairs with the attack on Pearl Harbor. And as a result of that, the United States has, for the last 80 years, been the preeminent world power on the globe. And that's a direct result of the Second World War.
And to this day, that persists. We are the nuclear power now. We demonstrated the first ever atomic bomb use to end the Second World War and established our dominance and have maintained it until now. But a lot has changed. Yes, we've had wars since then, Vietnam, Korea, the Cold War. I will include the War on Terror. But never since the Second World War, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, do I feel like the United States, as a people, as a country, as one voice, has had a common enemy. And I think we struggle today, if I were to ask the average individual, who is the United States' enemy right now? And the best answer I've come up with is that we are our own worst enemy right now. And I don't mean that to be poetic, but it feels like with the lack of someone else on the globe to hate, we seem to have a need as a society to have some hatred, to have an enemy. And I feel like that we have found our enemies within, that people tend to hate those people with different political ideology than them more than ever before. The hatred by the Republicans for Joe Biden was unbelievable. Likewise, the hatred by most Democrats for Donald Trump is equally as dramatic. And I feel like the lack of a global enemy and a common enemy has left many Americans looking for someone to hate, and they're hating people in our own country.
Well, let's also not forget, yes, you're absolutely right, the Japanese were a common enemy, even more so than the Germans. And part of that, of course, has a racial element to it. But let's not forget also that the Soviets, for the 45 years after the end of World War II, were our common enemy. And that was reflected in many issues of film, media, television, the news, and so forth.
Yeah, even up to and including the Olympic Games, where there was, well, it's supposed to be this spirit of togetherness, there did seem to linger a hatred for the USSR, for the Absolutely. Soviets, and for the Russians. And but now we don't, who do we hate now as a nation?
Well, as far as a foreign enemy to despise in any way, no, we don't have that. Occasionally, we make little overtures about the Chinese and their being an up and coming power and an enemy. But of course, we're so enmeshed with the Chinese for our manufacturing and so forth. It's hard even to hate them.
It's hard to hate your number one trade partner, isn't it?
Exactly. But no, we don't have what we had during the time of the Second World War, and then later in the Cold War, where you had this enemy to bring you again. And of course, this is the history not just of the United States, but it's the history of many countries. Is that many countries are brought together, and this is like nationalism at its core is like a shared suffering, and part of that is having a national enemy to go against. I mean, you saw that in the 1990s in the Balkans with Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, the hatred that was uncovered after the Soviets and the Yugoslavian communists were put out of power. And the same thing is happening for us, is that when we don't have that common enemy, we tend to begin to look toward each other to see what our differences are there.
You know, people are texting us and pointing to the war on terror, saying we had a common enemy after 9/11. Yes, there's no doubt about that. I think we turned it into, at least briefly, Iraq being our common enemy. But that was less having a country that was an enemy and more an ideology. Osama bin Laden, of course, the representation of that. But even now, we don't really seem to have there doesn't seem to be an identified terrorist organization that the United States still hates. And from time to time, yes, we hate the North Koreans, or yes, we hate the Iranians, but it's not this common hatred that we share as a nation as we have at times in the past.
You know, one of the things that I really have to give credit to George W. Bush, former President George W. Bush, for doing during the war on terror is that there was a real moment there where Islam, the people of Islam who follow the Islamic religion were, you know, in many ways were set up to be the big enemy. And then George W. Bush, who was one of the leaders of the war on terror, said, we're not at war with Islam. And we are at war with people who have corrupted that faith and have ruined its tenets for their own personal ends. And so we didn't exactly go all in. I mean, of course, there was some, you know, right wing and war hawks and so forth that really beat that drum, but it didn't really catch like it did with the Japanese in World War II or with the Soviets during the Cold War. And there's a great statement that Senator Arthur Vandenberg made at the time that Pearl Harbor happened. And Arthur Vandenberg was a Republican senator from California who was a vocal opponent of Franklin Roosevelt and never hesitated to criticize Franklin Roosevelt. On December the 8th, 1941, Vandenberg standing there along with President Roosevelt saying, my good friend, the president and I are going to war against the Japanese. And they asked him, well, why the change of direction? And he said, quite simply, politics stops at the water's edge. And that's what our country did during the Second World War. We put aside all our internal differences and we went to war against the common foe. We just haven't had that in the last 80 years.
And not that I would wish that, not that I want there to be some global threat or some enemy out there that is going to bring us to war, but I sure wish we could get to the water's edge some other way now because it just seems like, and you're more a student of history than I, but it just seems like it's unprecedented, maybe the Civil War aside, how this massive divide and hatred we have amongst ourselves for fellow Americans.
Well, I, I'm an academic, so I'm always going to go on the side of education. I think education is always the key. And people, when people educate themselves and they see the whole side of an argument, they're not going to just simply fall for whatever whoever's speaking the loudest and the harshest at that particular time. And unfortunately, and look, we have to acknowledge this in current President Trump. He speaks the loudest, and he speaks the most forceful in despising other people. Is that the case where Democratic presidents have done that in the past? Of course, they've done that in the past. It's up to the average American to educate themselves on it, and sometimes you just got to shut off social media and stay off of that, and go find the actual truth that's out there, because social media is simply a podium for anybody who can speak the loudest and the harshest sometimes.
Based on what you know of the pre-World War II era, between the First World War and the Second World War, was our nation like it is now without having that common enemy between the two world wars before we decided that it was time to end isolationism and get back into world affairs and enter the Second World War? Did we turn on ourselves like we are now?
Well, we didn't turn on ourselves back then nearly as much, although we did do it right after the First World War. We kind of turned on ourselves with the first Red Scare of the 1920s, in which President Wilson's Attorney General was accused of seeing a red behind every tree. But then, of course, the common enemy from 1929 until Pearl Harbor was the poverty of the nation, the Great Depression. There was an economic enemy to be fought during that time. And so, you know, whether or not the country would have a New Deal or whether it would stay the course with laissez-faire economics, that was the big argument that you know, consumed the nation at that time, was trying to get out of the Depression, trying to save the capitalist system that the New Deal was meant to do. So we weren't turning on ourselves nearly as much back then as we did later on.
So do we need a crisis, whether it's a world war or a depression or something else, to bring us together as a united United States?
Well, the history of this country does have moments where, you know, you're very familiar with the term wag the dog, where people will try to create a crisis and hopefully that'll bring people together. You can even go back to the Civil War, right at the outset of the Civil War. The Secretary of State, William Seward, was trying to start a war with Spain and France in order to unite the country and keep the secessionists from having their day. So we do have those moments where we try to unite the country under a common enemy. But when it's manufactured or it's contrived, the American people are pretty smart about that most of the time.
We're talking with UNO history and philosophy professor John Fitzmaurice III. When we come back, let's take a look at what we have learned or not learned from history to determine what the future may hold as a time when we have unprecedented hatred amongst Americans for each other, between political parties, between other divides that separate us. What does the future hold, and can we find some way without a crisis to get along better? Your thoughts. I want to hear from you. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. What do you think it's going to take for us to end this divisive hate that is so palpable now, not only in politics, but in communities, and seems to be just getting worse and worse, not better, as we reflect on 80 years ago today, ending the Second World War, when we may have been the most united in our history in our resolve together against a common enemy. Maybe since, the Revolutionary War. We'll get the professor's thoughts and yours. Jump on the phone right now or text us at 504-260-1870. In for Newell Norman on this Tuesday, as today is the day 80 years ago that the Japanese signed the surrender and officially ended the Second World War. And it just feels to me, while we have had common enemies since then, none like in that era, and the lack of now a current common enemy has left our nation more divided than ever. And it seems that many Americans feel a need to hate somebody, right? Not all Americans, but obviously many Americans. And without a common enemy to hate, it feels to me like we turn that hate on people within our borders, that we turn that hate on people in the other political party or with the other political philosophy. Text messages are coming in on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line at 504-260-1870. Horse crap! This is not about the lack of common enemies. Fascism is here. Trump deserves the hatred. Somebody else says, you are wrong. Russia is our enemy, as well as North Korea. And somebody else says, the matter of fact is that we're not having often uncomfortable conversations that we need to have about what's going on in our country. Our guest is Professor John Fitzmaurice III from UNO, history and philosophy professor. And Doc, what do you think about those texts?
Well, I mean, we've always been having substantial conversations in our society about what is wrong, who is doing what, who is, you know, assaulting the very fabric of American society. I mean, you know, we've had our Red Scares, we've had our Joseph McCarthy's, we've had our, you know, the protest movements of the 1960s that threatened to tear apart the nation during the Vietnam War. We're having that same discussion right now with the current president, who is certainly showing some very, and I'm going to be as diplomatic as possible on this, I mean, he's showing some serious issues with understanding the American law and the American Constitution. You know,
caring about American law and the American Constitution.
Well, and there's that too. And you said that, and I agree with that. And of course, you know, we have the current issue of burning the flag right now, and so you have people on both sides. One saying that this is, you know, desecrating the nation and undermining the patriotism of the nation. Others are saying, no, this is what the First Amendment is there for. This is what the men of the Second World War fought to protect the right of people to be as despicable as they want to be, as long as it is simply the freedom of expression. So, you know, we continue to have these discussions all the time. Any advanced society, and we are, no matter what other people may say, we're an advanced society, we're an advanced nation, we are having these substantial conversations about enemies, about hatred, and about what it takes to bring us together other than hatred.
It just feels to me like those conversations now are more hateful against fellow Americans than they have been at any point in my adult life. At any point that I recall, I don't remember politicians and base supporters viscerally hating people of the other party so much, so openly, and the conversation being so hateful.
It's our generation, Dave. It is, you know, it's happening during our time, and so therefore it is the most important thing that happens for us. But go ahead and ask the person who was facing the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s. Ask the person who was facing the Attorney General under Woodrow Wilson in the early 1920s when Bolshevism was first making its appearance. You know, ask the person who was sitting in the U.S. Senate chamber in 1856 when a representative came over and literally clubbed Charles Sumner, U.S. Senator, on top of the head, to the point where his skull was fractured and he was rendered unconscious and out of commission for the next 4 years. And people in the presses of of the South were saying, buy the man more canes, and the people in the North were saying, our country's falling apart at the seams. Every generation faces that same exact issue. Are we so hateful of each other for having different views? And it goes even as far back as the Revolution.
So based on that history, what can we reasonably expect for our future without another world war, which some believe we're on the brink of, without a major crisis like a terror attack or a Great Depression to bring us all together? What does the future hold for us based on what we know from that history?
Well, we better hope that there's not a world war, because it's going to last probably a few months at the most, and then there'll be nothing left to hate because there'll be nothing left. And so that's, you know, it's a clarion call. You don't want to go around trying to start a big time war to bring your country together. That ship is long ago sailed, and we do not want it back given the current circumstances. But we have gotten better. Our country continues to go forward. Yes, there are people that want to drag us back. Yes, there are people in power that want to drag us back. But on the whole, we go forward. I mean, everybody got upset at Representative Jill Wilson for yelling at Barack Obama during the State of the Union address saying, you lie. And they said, oh, that was a terrible breach of protocol and bad manners. Well, it sure beats the example that I gave, you know, of what happened more than 100 years earlier with physical violence happening on the floor of the U.S. Senate. So we get better. We figure out better ways. And sometimes we're not perfect, and sometimes we get it wrong, but we continue to get better and better. The biggest problem that we have in our generation today, Dave, I really believe is social media. Social media has taken the cap off of feelings and sentiments and so forth that people would never have said in public, out loud, in company. And yet, from their desk, from their mother's basement, from wherever, people are yelling out all sorts of vile and despicable things. But that's where it's happening. It's happening there. It's not happening as much out in the public sector or the public arena as much as we did it in the past.
And I think there is a bit of a chicken and egg there, because much of what you see, or at least began to see with the advent of social media, was people who figured out, wait, the more divisive I am, the more visceral I am, the meaner I am, the more responses I get, the more shares I get, the more clicks and likes and views and so forth. And I think that many of us started to get a distorted sense of what people really thought and felt, because a lot of the people posting this stuff were not necessarily believing it, but doing it just to get a reaction. But that sent the message to others that it's okay to behave this way on social media. And now many of the people doing it do feel it, do mean it, and do believe it.
And they have an example setter that's right now in the Oval Office. There's no better a purveyor of that sort of thing than Donald J. Trump. And I know that I'm going to probably get a lot of hate and brushback on that, but that's simply the fact, is that he has perfected that in many ways. And when you have the president of the United States doing it, then the rest of the people that think that same way are going to come out as well.
And I think that, love him or hate him, you cannot argue with the fact that Donald Trump realized that creating division was his path to election. And after having done it successfully once, turned it up to another level in his third attempt to get elected, his second successful attempt, and found that it did work, that division is a way for him anyway to win support and to get back to the White House.
And that's true. But I don't want to go off too far off track today from what happened 80 years ago. And what happened 80 years ago, we have to remember, is that, you know, we call those men and women that served in the Second World War the greatest generation. And they are the example. They are the ones that we can look back to and say, okay, we need to follow that example. Of course, there's very few of those people left. They're beginning to, you know, they've almost completely died off now.
Yeah, well, the war ended 80 years ago.
Yes, it ended 80 years ago. So, I mean, even if you were a teenager at the end of the war, you're in your high 90s at this point. But these folks have left us a legacy. They have left us an example to follow of how you put aside your issues and you come together not to hate a common enemy, but to come together for a common purpose. And the common purpose was to make the world safe for democracy and republican government, to make the world safe from totalitarianism, to make the world a place where if you were a Jew or you were a minority, you were safe in the country in which you lived, which was not the case prior to World War II. And it was the case later on in much of the world, and it wasn't perfect, and there was still plenty of problems. And I mean, hey, we still had Jim Crow over in America when the war ended. But we showed that we could come together, race, religion, background, social economic group, came together in one great effort to finish a job that needed to be done.
And Professor, I think that is a great point that all, were it not for the United States getting into the war, were it not for the United States and the Allies winning the war, we would not be having this conversation today. We might be under Japanese or Nazi rule. The world would look very different. We would not be living in a democratic republic, and you and I would not be free to have this conversation were it not for the Americans and their allies winning the Second World War 80 years ago today.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Things would have been a whole lot different. Could we have been under the foot of the Nazis or the Japanese? Possibly. Or we might have been in a situation where, you know, we'd have been so divided on the earth that we could have had a different type of Cold War if we had not gotten involved in this. But there was no question of us getting involved in it. We had to, and we did it, and they did the job. And they had to be saluted for all of that.
And we should obviously and very clearly never forget those lessons learned. Do you fear, now that it has been 80 years and that we have not had this type of conflict, yes, we had the Cold War, yes, we had the Korean and Vietnam Wars, yes, we had the War on Terror. Do you ever fear that because it has been 80 years, though, since a world war, that we have societal amnesia and that at some point people forget the lessons learned?
I think that the adult generations certainly can forget it and have forgotten it, or at least act like they've forgotten it. But you go down to the World War II Museum, Dave, and you see the young kids that are coming in by busload, any chance they get to come tour. And that's your hope. That is your, your area of where you can feel a little more optimistic, is that these young people are being told that lesson and they're not forgetting, because you can see it in those young people that go in there. They are very interested, and it's not just interested in, you know, how a PBY plane or a Japanese Zero or how a piece of artillery or so forth shoots. It's about understanding why the war happened in the first place and how it's up to them, the coming generations, to keep that from happening.
Professor, I really appreciate your spending some time with us today and helping put all of this in perspective and share with us your vast knowledge, historically speaking, so we get some understanding of where we've been and perhaps where we're going. Professor Fitzmaurice, anything else you want to share before we let you run?
No, thank you for having me on the show this morning. And whenever you get a chance and see a World War II veteran, as few as they are, make sure you just go up there and say thank you for doing the job that needed to be done and welcome home. That's what we should do to every soldier that fought in every war.
80 years ago today, the official end of the Second World War. Thank you, Professor Fitzmaurice. I know we'll be talking to you in the future. Have a great rest
of your
Tuesday. All right.
You too.
I'm Dave Cohen in for Newell Norman. We got a couple of callers waiting to make their comments. We'll let you do that after this. Also getting some texts on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. That gave me a lot to think about and realize that our situation now is not as perhaps unique as I thought, but still really with the advent of social media and targeted, divided media, particularly when we're talking about television, cable television, and broadcast television now, in many ways picking sides rather than presenting full and complete stories. It just feels like, and I don't want a massive catastrophe, world war, economic crisis, or anything else, or terror attack, God forbid, to bring us back together. But I do wonder, if we keep going down this road and we keep getting further and further divided, what the future holds. And I don't like what I fear could be the direction that we end up down the road even further. So I want to hear from you. 504-260-1870. James, you're up next. And your calls at 504-260-1870. One person texted us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line and said, Aretha said it best, respect. People have lost this critical trait. Somebody else says, have you been living under a rock? They all do it. Taking issue with our commentary on President Trump leading the way with his negativity and divisiveness. I wasn't picking on the president. I was noting his strategy. I'm not passing judgment. I'm saying he found that it worked and it got him back into the White House. And yes, the other politicians, by and large, also have found that divisiveness, hate, and pettyism do work in seeking political office at some levels and in some places. But I will stand on the fact that when you have the president of the United States setting the example, regardless of their party, regardless of who they are, that changes the tone for everyone else. Somebody else texts, there are two very distinct and different political perspectives in our country today. I'm not sure that's new, but the way that we discuss, and I use that word very lightly, discuss our differences, I think, is more visceral than at any point, at least in my lifetime. Now, it says, I agree with the professor, ignorance should be our common enemy, but it seems like war most often is the first casualty of truth. And then there's this text at 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line. It seems to me social media is nothing but negativity. It is by and large negativity, but I still enjoy being able to find out where my friends and friends and family are having a good time, where they're vacationing, where they're having a great meal, who's having a baby, who's getting married. I think there's value in social media. I think that there is something to be gleaned and gained. I think some of the funny things people post can be entertaining. And I love the fact that everyone has an outlet where they can share their thoughts, happiness, comedy, whatever. The problem is that even when people are being happy on social media, the comments almost always turn negative. Someone starts making fun of them. Someone starts commenting on their appearance. Someone starts attacking them on some level, even when they're just being happy. So I don't think it's nothing but negativity, but there's way too much negativity there, and it's kept me from spending much time on social media lately and being very careful on what I click. James, thanks for calling. You're on WWL. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Dave. And as I said before, it's always so good to hear you on the radio. What a day 80 years ago must have been, right? What a joy throughout the country. I want to talk about Trump. How divisive he is. Now, you are an experienced and valuable member of the local news media, but Trump has attacked people such as you over the years. He's called...
I don't take it personally, James.
I'm sorry?
I don't take it personally.
Oh, I understand, but your profession. He has called the news media the enemy of the people. Now, those are words of Vladimir Lenin and Stalin. The news media is not the enemy of the country. So what does he do? He then turns to the other party, the Democrats. What does he call them? Donald Trump has said that the Democrats and the Democratic Party, and by the way, it is the Democratic Party, they are the enemy from within, and says they're more dangerous than Russia and China. Think about that, folks.
But James, you don't think that the Democrats now are also doing much of the same, that the divisiveness, maybe you can trace its roots, but regardless of where it came from, now there is hate spewing from both sides all the time, name-calling, belittling, and so forth.
That is true, but not to the extent that Trump has done, and I'll show you why. Recently, he said, concerning the Democrats who voted against his big, ugly, or beautiful bill, he said, quote, "I hate them," meaning the Democrats. "I really hate them. I cannot stand them because I really believe they hate our country."
And that is, by its definition, spreading hate. You're right. But I think that hate has become equal opportunity. I'm not rooting for either side, as I have said many, many times on this show when I fill in and on my own show. I am registered no party. I'm not an independent. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat, because I don't like the way any of the individuals who are active in politics these days express their thoughts and viewpoints when it includes hatred, name-calling, belittling, and divisiveness. I know it works, but it hurts as well. Listen, we can continue this conversation throughout the program, but for now I want to say this to wrap up this hour. The last thing I wanted is for this discussion about hate to turn into finger-pointing and hating someone for being hateful, because it doesn't get any more hypocritical than that, right? Listen, we all have our First Amendment right. And as a free nation where we thrive on allowing people to share their views and express themselves, I'm not going to be that critical of people who have found a successful way to get their point across and get into power. That having been said, I think it's awful that we're at a point in our evolution as human beings that the thing that motivates us so much to vote for one person over another is hate for the other person. And I think that it's awful that we need a common enemy or a common crisis so that we don't hate each other within our own borders.